So Monday, Thursday morning, talk one.
So any lucid dreams last night? Any psychotic breakdowns from the galantamine? None of the above. Psychotic break? Prescription strength. Yeah. Friday, 8 milligrams. Can you turn up the heat, please? Oh, no. First of all, I don't know how. Secondly, I think it's really warm in here. I would prefer, honestly, because I think the temperature's fine.
No?
It's cold.
Can we shut some windows, maybe?
Yeah, I honestly don't know how to turn the heat up. Probably it's back there. You can close the windows. Okay. I guess we can close the windows. Yeah. Cool. Well, I don't think we really have time to actually, unfortunately, sorry. I was just curious how many generally had one. And if not, here's something that's quite important. Well, there we go. Cool. They're warm.
66.
That's actually the ideal sleeping temperature. That's the sweet spot. What we're doing when we work with lucidity is we're working, obviously, with heightening awareness. And whether or not we have lucid dreams or not, there's something happening by engaging in these practices. The analogy I use is like when you put a big vat pot of water on a stove and turn on heat. It doesn't immediately come to a boil, right? So depending on how big the water, how large the pot of water is, depending on how cold the water is, depending on how much heat is on, it takes a greater or lesser period of time for things to start to cook. And so this is really common with these nocturnal practices, and why we're going to be initiating some support, which we'll talk about on Saturday. You know, you're putting heat into the system. And this idea of self-help, things are happening whether you know it or not. Those of you who are Buddhists, this is the transformation of the eighth consciousness, the Alaya. That's taking place here whether you know it or not. And it's helpful to know because the single biggest issue with lucid dreaming is discouragement. You know, you're putting all this effort in, effort, nothing's happening. Well, something is happening. It's just happening below the radar screen. So if you just stay with it, from a pure mechanical point of view, sooner or later, you will have a phase transformation. You will come to a boil, and you'll start to have these dreams. And you also may notice just by engaging in these practices, you know, your sense of awareness, lucidity altogether will start to heighten in the way you relate to your mind, to your world, basically to everything. So don't worry if it doesn't seem to be popping right away. A couple things. Tonight, you know, obviously this afternoon at 11:30, school's out for the summer.
Yay!
Remember that? Is it Ted Nugent? Who did that song? Oh, Alice Cooper. School's out for summer, remember? And so we're free. We think we're free, but we're actually not. Until, you know, dinner. And then the evening, again, totally optional. If you go to Sedona and you want to come back later, don't worry. But we are, for those of us who are hanging here, we are going to meet again at 7:30. I ain't going to be riffing on anything. I mean, we can have a little Q&A if you want. I got some awesome videos, really cool videos. One on hypnosis, because we're going to talk a little bit about the power of hypnosis and whether we know it or not, how hypnotized we are right now. And if you've ever witnessed stage, I've been trained in medical hypnosis. I use it in my practice. Do you do it, Lena, in your dental work?
Sometimes.
Yeah, it's incredibly compelling stuff. And so if we have time, that's an option, is to watch a really awesome TED Talk about this guy doing stage hypnosis. Has anybody ever seen this stuff live? The first time I saw it, you know, some 40 years ago, I was stunned. I didn't know why. I left the auditorium just feeling really disturbed. And I didn't know why. I said, why? Something really profound just happened up here. I couldn't understand why. And so I will talk a little bit this morning about hypnosis. So an option for tonight is to watch this video, this TED Talk on hypnosis, which is really cool. And also I have a couple really, I think, interesting videos, brain game videos on illusion. Because as we start sliding into the teachings on emptiness, we're going to be seeing how it is that we are tricked by our, not our senses, because our senses themselves are fundamentally not only neutral, our senses themselves are fundamentally pure. In fact, that's how when we contact reality, we quite literally come to our senses, of which, by the way, the mind is considered the sixth sense. And so we can use illusions to help us find our way back to the truth. It's very interesting. And so some of these videos on illusion, and I think, Lynn, you were telling me about a TED Talk you really liked, right? Wasn't it you on illusion? I thought it was you. But anyway, I've got some cool stuff. And so bring your popcorn, bring your beer. I can't bring beer here, but you get the idea. Totally open, relaxed kind of evening, all right? One thing, this is what I did. I had to run back to my room to get something. I want to share something that I do pretty constantly that I invite you to do. It's one reason I gave you those silly hats outside of protecting you from the sun. It's one reason I gave you those cards. Do you remember what you do? That's my business card, right? Is this a dream? Do you remember what you do with those? You remember? You know, you look at it, pull it out of your line of vision, bring it back in, right? If it doesn't change, you're probably awake. If it does change, you're either tripping, dreaming, or dead. Because if you do that in a dream and you bring it back, again, they've done studies on this. I think it's like 95% of the time something will change. The color, the font, the size, or whatever. Same thing with the hats. That's why I give you the hats, you know, to look at it and see if it changes. And other things you can do, again, kind of retrofitting some classic lucid dreaming instruction, and I did this as I was walking back and forth, I do it here a lot, is do things like look for your shadow. And these, by the way, these next two or three things, these also conflate with what are called death signs. Because according to the Bardo teachings, there are certain indicators that you can look for in the Bardos, just like in the dream, that will clue you into the fact that you're dead or dreaming. And just like in a non-lucid dream, the tradition says the biggest problem in being in the Bardos is actually realizing that you're in them. In other words, it's like the movie Sixth Sense, right? Where Bruce Willis, until the very, actually, spoiler alert, is like 15 years old. You know, he doesn't realize he's dead until the very last part of the movie. And so that happens because just like in a non-lucid dream, we bring our habits with us. We bring our solidifying, reifying tendencies with us. And so, you know, again, a major reason we don't recognize the dream to be real is because we don't question the status of appearance. It's a deeper rendering of the bumper sticker, question authority. We go with the flow. Oh, but that's just the way things are. Well, yeah, it's the way things are from the point of view of being asleep. It's not the way things truly are from the point of being awake. And the reason we take this to be real is we have not yet developed a stance. It's called an Archimedean point. From Archimedes, you know, give me a place to stand and I will move the earth. We have not developed a stance upon which we can look at this world and see this as a dream. See? We'll come back. And so what we want to start to do is start to question authority. I mean, in many ways, you know, what's the jingle? We don't want to answer our questions. We want to question our answers. We don't want to answer our questions. We want to question our answers. This is the Socratic method. You know, just really challenging. And it's like Mark Twain. I mean, like, Mark Twain and Trungpa Rinpoche, the great masters of the one-liners. You know, where Mark Twain says, you know, it's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you do know that just ain't so. Wow. You know, thinking that this is real and awake, it just ain't so. Thinking that you're awake when you're dreaming, it just ain't so. But if we don't challenge that, and it takes a warrior to sometimes stand up and say, in fact, somebody mentioned this, that the emperor has no clothes. The emperor of reality has no clothes. And so one of the things that I do this all the time, is that, you know, I'm walking outside and I look down. There's a shadow. Oh, I'm probably alive on this planet. But if I look for my shadow in a dream and try it, see what happens. Try it. There is no sun and moon unless you make one in the dream state. There's only the light of the mind. In fact, that's what illuminates the objects in the dream. They're just the light of the mind taking shape as the dream. And so in the after-death state, exactly the same way, there is no sun or moon in the bardos, because actually we'll see there's no male or female bindu. Again, this is just beyond profound. So when you're walking around, check to see if you leave a shadow. If you don't, you're either dreaming, tripping, or dead. And so what you do when you look down and you see there ain't no shadow, then you conduct a state check. And again, there's so many ways to do this, right? The card is one. You know my favorite. You know, you just walk along. Why do you do this? Huh? Are you good? Yeah, so, you know, if you're awake, chances are good you're going to come back down. If you're dreaming, and I'm not kidding, I have launched probably 500 lucid dreams this way. I jump up, and several things happen. Usually I keep going. Hey, man, I'm either dreaming, sleeping, you know, tripping, or dead. Instant lucidity. Or sometimes what happens, variations, and they're hysterical. I'll jump up, I'll come back down, and I'll keep going down through the earth.
Whoa.
Or another variation is I'll jump down, I'll hop up, come down in slow motion, and for some bizarre reason, you know, I'll tuck my knees in, and I land on my knees, ga-boing, 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 ga-boing. I can't do that in waking reality. And so these are the little thingies that will not only wake you up into your dreams, they will wake you up into the dream at the end of time, so that then you can transform a non-lucid bardo experience. Which if you don't take control of that, just like in a nighttime dream, what takes control of your nighttime dream? Your bad habits. What is that reincarnates? Your bad habits. That's what takes control. If you don't take control, your habits take control. There's no magic here. It's just physics. It's just mechanics. It's in exactly the same way the tradition says in the bardos, if you don't take control over the bardos, what takes control? The winds of karma. And that's what's described in the karmic bardo of becoming, or really the windy bardo of becoming, where if you don't wake up, the farther into that bardo you go, the windier it gets, until that wind, that force of karma, eventually throws you into form, because that's what you will eventually take refuge in, because that's what you've been trained to identify with. Does that make sense? So the other things you can do, just a second, right? The other things you can do is look in the mirror. This is kind of like a vampire movie. You know? Vampires don't cast shadows, right? Yeah? Vampires look in mirrors, they don't cast reflections. So that's the other thing you want to do. I also do this every morning. Look in the mirror, there I am. So far, so good. Reminds me of a joke, really bad joke. So there's this, you're at the, whatever, Empire State Building, in a really highfalutin dinner party, sitting out on this patio, standing out with all these people, beautiful, you know, Schubert quartet being played, you know, cocktails and hors d'oeuvres are being served. And you're like, yeah, this is as good as it gets, right? And you're hanging out there, and all of a sudden, and again, pardon the gallows humor here, all of a sudden, you know, a body comes hurtling down. You know, somebody's jumped off the top. And as they go hurtling down past this little patio, they're heard to say, as they fly by all the people, so far, so good. We are all hurtling towards the ground. We just don't know when we're gonna go spalat, right? Brian, it's like I'm weirding you out today. You weirded me out last night, I'm weirding you out tonight. So look to see if there's a reflection. Do a state check. When you're walking in snow or sand, look to see if you leave a footprint. You know, all these kind of classic little thingies you can do to kind of, you know, grease the skids so that when you enter these other states that otherwise you normally bring your unquestioned habits with to, you can now start to question and say, oh, wow, I can't do this. And so again, the really good news about lucidity, one flash and you're in, right? Recognition and liberation are simultaneous. Recognition and liberation are simultaneous, as it says in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. One glimpse of recognition and you're lucid. And so you can use these little silly things like I do all the time to work with this. We should probably use the mic. Sorry, Carrie, do we have it? Because we are trying to record this. Actually, I repeat it, Frank. Go ahead.
Sorry?
I'll repeat it while Carrie's getting the mic. This is a great question.
It feels that a little bit like when you go out and look at the nighttime sky, or as the Kala Chakra says, as above, so below, as outside, so inside, that the entire universe has its correlation within the body, and that the sun and moon are dependent upon the body. So my understanding is that the veil, at the time of death, the veil descends from the toward the heart, the female
lead
to rises, which, by the way, is another way of practicing
mindfulness. Yes, exactly.
And then when they get to the heart, you go dark.
Yep.
And at that point, you will never see the sun.
That's right.
Yeah. Something like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is why when we talk about the subtle body system, we talk literally. It's called Zambo Mangden in Tibet, a profound inner reality. Now you start to see why it's just a little bit profound.
It's
beyond profound. I mean, the reason we see a sun and a moon out there right now is because we have a sun and a moon within us here. And when those are no longer present, you no longer see a sun and moon, which is one way you can detect that you're dead when you're dead. It's like, hello. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what do you do then?
Oh, geez. Those are all the teachings on the karmic part of the time. You fundamentally quit, you know, the best thing you can do is FedEx your consciousness into a Pure Land, you know, and then the Pure Land teachings are about that, the Marlowe teachings are about that. I don't think we have time to go there. Yeah.
Just a reflection.
Humor is a very serious matter.
That's the reflection.
Yeah, exactly. You know the etymology of the word humor? It means liquidity. So humor is actually a byproduct of de-reification. As you liquefy reality, you become more humorous in both senses because you realize the whole thing is just a big bloody joke. Okay? So we should take humor very seriously. Yeah, exactly. Frank.
You mentioned the book Zambo Mangden.
Zambo Mangden. Yeah, you're the designated librarian of this group.
Just was wondering if I could
Yeah, Profound Inner Principles. It's one of these X-rated books.
So it's not translated?
It is translated, but you may have a hard time getting it. You have to have a prescription.
I call it YouTube.
Yeah, my dear friend Elizabeth Callahan, a genius translator, 2-3 year retreats. She was the first person to actually translate this monumental text. It's called Profound. She translated it as Profound Inner Principles. There are other, Thangpa Rinpoche has some commentary on it. Yeah, I'll leave that for what that is. Michael?
You're not going to recognize, you're not going to want, you're in a dream and you're one.
This is a success. Like when your mind is completely stunned and you can't say anything, that means you're getting somewhere.
Well, you're not going to test to see if you're lucid in a dream unless you're already realizing a little bit at least.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. So there's pre-lucidity. Great question. There's pre-lucidity already taking place. Yep. Yep. And something will start, you know, something doesn't fit. That's what dream signs are all about, right? And that's why, again, retrofitting stuff in classic lucid dreaming, that's why you work with dream signs. You know, a bird hits the window. That's a little odd. A dream sign is any incongruity, discontinuity, any weird thing that happens, which once you start to sensitize yourself, happens all the time. Weird, you know, stuff happens all the time. Bird hits the window, something falls off the shelf, whatever. You do a state check. Because what constitutes a large part of our dreams is weird stuff. Just, that's what we define as a dream, just weird stuff. If we go along with the weird stuff, we stay stuck, non-lucid. If we start anytime something weird happens, or synchronicity happens, you know, like when the thunderbolt lightning fits, jump up. You start doing that now, you find yourself, by the way, doing it more and more. What is found now is found then. You'll start doing it in the dreams. And then all of a sudden that pink elephant that last night entered your dream and you didn't say anything about, you go, hey, wait a second, I don't usually have pink elephants in my living room. State check, ding, you're awake. Okay? Cool. One last one, and then I need to talk about fear. Myra?
Yeah, please.
Wait, please.
There is no moon or sun, but it's not black.
Where?
In that descending and uprising sensation in the heart, that the space is...
It's black for the ego. Yes, it's the light, it's actually the light of the Great Eastern Sun, but and this is sleep yoga material, so it's black for the ego, because the ego can't, the archetype of thing, the mother of all things, can't relate to no thing. How do we experience no thing? We don't. So we go black. And so when no thingness is introduced in deep dreamless sleep or death, if we're not familiar with it, we don't recognize it, we go black. But if we do recognize it by doing the practices, again, it's a beautiful segue that we're going to start this morning, non-referential or formless shamatha, then what happens is instead of blacking out, we light up. And so then you're, you know, the black light of the mind is revealed as the formless nature of who you are. And so for a yogi, they say death isn't death. Death is a mini awakening. Death is actually enlightenment. And so again, when we die, it's a wrathful form of liberation. If we've already been liberated, it's a homecoming. You're just returning to the nature that provisionally resides in your heart center.
Which is the same light through the when you walk through the stages of the bardo.
Well, it's the same light that's on all the time. It's just in the stages of the bardo. This is like, again, a little technicality. What you're talking about, Ira, is the light of the luminous bardo on the top. When we're entering the karmic part of becoming, of course, this light is never off. It's always on. You know, this is your 24, this is your 7-Eleven mind. This store is always open. This light's always on. But when it manifests in the bardo of becoming, it manifests in a slightly different way, because then that light starts to take form. But then, again, I'll just say, the forms then actually manifest as the expressions of the light. And I'll say this because it's just another one of these, like, when you're having a dream, and you're seeing a dream, where is the light, so to speak, that allows you to see the contents of the dream? Where is it? Well, it's actually manifesting as the content itself. You see?
It's actually manifesting
as the content itself.
Yeah.
So the content of the dream is nothing but frozen light, as in fact this is. This is nothing but frozen light. The mind expressing itself as thought form, as dream form, is nothing more than the light of the mind taking form in and as so-called mental objects. See? Comes back to this. See? So there's no external light source there. There's, you know, if there is, show it to me. It's not there. But yet you still see. Where does the light that allows that seeing to come from? We're talking about non-duality here. And when you talk about non-duality from a dualistic perspective, the usual result at best is contradiction, usually paradox. And the usual affective response is what I'm seeing with everybody here. Can I tease you just a little bit? Is it okay? So I have my dog, Tashi. Tashi is the most adorable dog in the world. And please, I say this with tremendous affection. Tashi, I have to show you pictures of Tashi. He's a Catan. He's beyond cute. And so what's so adorable, and I'm sure your dog probably does this, is when I'll sit with Tashi, he's like my therapy dog, I'll sit with Tashi, and I'll go, Tashi, should we go for a walk? He goes, his ears come up, Tashi, should we get the kitties? And it's the most endearing possible thing because Tashi's trying so hard to understand me. And so I get the Tashi look out here, right? And everybody's going. When you start to try to talk about non-duality from a dualistic perspective, it's exceedingly difficult to do. And you will start to see this when we come back from our break, if you decide to come back. When we start to slide into the teachings on emptiness, this is fantastic segues to where we're going. We're going to incredibly formless states, eventually non-dual states, which is really, it's where we want to go. I didn't say this yesterday, but when Ken Wilber talks about this, it's a beautiful image that Ken has around this, is that when the involutionary trajectory projection starts, one image is it's like a rubber band being stretched. The rubber band is being stretched from formlessness out into form. And then so when it bottoms out, there's tension, right? Contraction at its max. And then there's a pull. There's a pull to return back to source. That pull is there because we've been stretched away from the source. The rubber band is now stretched. And we feel this tension as a sense of disquietude, as a sense of emptiness in the pejorative sense, that's fundamentally whispering in our ears, something's missing here. Something's not quite right. We don't know what's missing. We just know we're hungry. And so what does most of the Western world do? It eats. It eats. And so obesity is an epigenetic expression of this. Materialism, consumerism, is an epiphenomenal expression of this. But the biggest problem is we're eating the menu instead of the meal, and what's the result? Instead of getting full, we get fat. With our ideologies, our belief systems, with body weight, with BMI, you name it. Because we feel this emptiness, this tension, something's missing, but we don't know what. And so that tension that we're feeling is the pull, the call of our being saying, come home, come home. And so we feel that, and eventually we wake up to the fact, hey, there's something not quite right here. And then when we acquiesce to that rubber band pulling us in, we surrender to it. And it will bring us back to the source. It will do so, it'll snap back when we die. It'll snap back when we go into sleep. It snaps back between every single thought. But the tension that brought you to this program, the tension that brings you to the spiritual path, is an affective response of this stretching of the mind into form, and now the calling to return. So the closer we get, the less tension there is, the more relaxation there is, until we finally arrive, either at the moment of death or in deep meditation, where we take this massive exhalation. What's the last thing that we will do as formed bodies when we die? We will exhale. Exhale! As a good yoga practitioner, remember? Be sure to exhale, and then you come back home. The tension now, the rubber band is back. There you go. Okay. Two quick things.
Very quick. Last night, I was in a dream on fear. Fear is a rubber chicken.
Fear is a rubber chicken. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome, Frank. Yeah. We got to get back to fear, by the way.
So I'm still in this rabbit hole of the analogy I've been doing.
Oh, yeah.
The
inner respiration ceases. Yeah.
And then it's clarified for you, the question, it becomes dark, totally dark from the point of view, because ego no longer has anything to make something out.
Yes, exactly.
But isn't it immediately after that tension that the full the luminosity of the Dharmakaya presents itself?
Exactly.
And you know, try to remember the test. That if you have practiced in your life to sustain grip, then you may the moment that presents itself when you recognize that could be a long moment. Whereas if
yes.
You don't even know about it.
No, it depends on how familiar you are.
It's a level of familiarization.
So yes.
It's actually liberation presents itself right then.
Yes.
And that gate is easily missed.
Yes. Yes.
And if you miss it, then the forms, the awakened forms, begin to present themselves.
Beautiful.
So you have more chance.
Yes. That's exactly right. And at that point, those are the archetypes. These aren't even Platonic archetypes that you're talking about. These are the archetypes that arise right here, phase two of the luminous Bhagavad Dharmata, when the fundamental light of the clear light mind is now refracted into the five primordial colors of the Buddha families, from which eventually the subtle body is created, from which eventually this body is created, from which eventually this body is created. See? And it all starts with
that. Okay, it's with you right to the last one. What did you say about this body, the body of the phenomenal
the body of the cosmos,
the body of the entire universe? So the whole universe is a manifestation of mind.
That's right.
Yeah. Put that in your pocket.
So. Yeah, exactly. Well said, the child of the noble family. Are we warm enough now?
Yes.
Okay, we have to talk about fear. Don't worry, Steph, we'll get that. This is always my challenge. I have to say to you, this is my favorite part. I love this kind of communication thing. But I also, you know, and I will give you these feedback forms on Saturday. I take feedback super seriously. The feedback forms I'll give you about this program, I read them, Cindy reads them. I really go over these things. And one of the things, a very common thing is, at least from last year and others, is, you know, too much Q&A. And that's why I try to relegate that towards the evening. And again, you understand, you can please some of the people all the time, all the people sometimes where you get it. I do my best. If I had my choice, I would just hang with you and just rip and rap for the whole 6 days. That's my favorite part, because then I learn from you. But I think you get what I'm working with here. Okay? There you go. So, back to fear. Before we take our little break. So, we left last night. Feels like a soap opera here. Yesterday, Bill and Jane
we left with this notion of fear being the primordial emotion of samsara.
Fundamentally, it is fear that initiates this descent,
that initiates the contraction, of which is still operative right now. And that's what I'm trying to point out to you, is to show you how this big bang of fear has its mini bangs in this existential anxiety that actually abides at the center of our being right here and now. And so fear is the primary emotion of samsara, because at the moment of death, if we don't recognize ourselves as no thing, again, ego says, I'm not nobody, right? Damn it, I'm not nobody, I'm somebody. And so when our nobodiness is literally and metaphorically pointed out, when this body crumbles and we dissolve and return into the lap of the mother of our own mind, and we don't recognize it, there's fear is generated. And there's subliminal fear that takes place, the fear of space, the fear of truth, the fear of emptiness, the fear of who we really are. And from that fear is born this contraction. I mean, we all know what fear feels like. I mean, have you ever been like an intense panic really intense fear? What is the primordial affect of response, emotional response? Tremendous contraction, right? Holding is defined by holding. And so that then becomes the archetype. That's the archetype, the first form. That's what archetype means. First form, primordial form of samsara. Fear, as we will see, becomes the mood, the black mood of the self contraction, which is actually a double entendre. The self is contraction. And so begins then the descent in Christianity, in Christian terms. Then begins the fall of man, creation of man, creation of form. Being evicted, we evict ourselves from the Garden of Eden. And so we start to descend as an avoidance strategy, to avoid truth, fear of truth, fear of the truth of our inherent non-existence, fear of the truth of emptiness of reality. And so this is, again, what we'll be talking about today, and then especially after our little break. And so the way this works is it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. The Upanishads, you know, the sacred commentarial traditions of the Brahmanic Hindu tradition, very famously say, where there is other, there is fear. Well, the immediate application is where there is self, there is fear. Because you can't have other without self. They co-emerge. You see, they arise together. You can't have other without self. So where there is other, there is fear, immediately implies where there is self, there is fear. So what this means is the self is quite literally, as we'll see, embodied fear, if it's not recognized for what it is. Yeah? and so this particular fear is at the center of the samsaric mandala, which we are now going to explore. And as I said last night, and I want to reiterate this because I think it's of some importance, is that what we're fundamentally trying to do is unearth this archetypal blind spot, this ignorance, which really is the center of this. And we're going to see how we're going to replace ignorance slash form with wisdom slash emptiness. That's where we're going over the next 3 days. We're going to do this heart transplant that I talked to you about. We're going to get rid of the egoic heart, which is ignorance form. We're going to transplant it. Of course, we don't have to transplant anything. We just have to transplant wisdom, awaken into wisdom, because this is already here. And so we're going to replace the center of the samsaric mandala. You know the term mandala? You know, those beautiful diagrams, you know, that have Jung used them a lot. Tremendous explanatory descriptive power in what's called mandala principle. And so that's really where we're going. And what we fundamentally want to do is unearth this archetypal blind spot, this ignorance. And by definition, ignorance is the blindest of all blind spots. It's when you don't see that you don't see. I mean, that's how blind it is. You know,
we don't see that we don't see. And so, because it's so blind, it's hard to work. This is what's called the cognitive obscuration. You may remember, probably don't, in that brief quotation from Bessna Wallace last night, where she says something about cognitive and affective emotions or obscurations. The fundamental cognitive obscuration is ignorance. The affective, afflictive expression of that is what? Fear. We're afraid of the unknown. We're afraid of we don't know, of what we don't know. We're afraid of the dark, which is why darkness, again, is a code word for ignorance. The only reason it's dark out there is because it's dark in here. You illuminate the darkness in here, you're going to illuminate the darkness out there. Like I said last night, it's not dark to God. It's not dark to the Buddha. It's only dark to the egoic mind. And so in order to unearth, to bring the crowbar in and extract this most intractable, insidious of all obscurations, we have to work with this afflictive, affective expression, which is fear. And so therefore, as I mentioned last night, and this is of considerable importance, if you really want to grow in this life, if you really want to wake up in this life, go to the places that scare you. Go to the dark. Go to the places that scare you. Hema Chodron has made a career out of this, our dear Dharma sister. She's made a career out of this. Literally wrote a book called The Places That Scare You. Because if you go to the black light, if you go to the places that scare you, those are the minions, the guardians of your ignorance. And if you want to unearth it, you have to do the opposite of what the ego wants to do. You have to, you know, turn away from the propensity to follow your bliss. When Joseph Campbell said that, it has a provisional validity. I'm not dissing that totally. But if you only follow your bliss, you're just going to get blissed out. You're going to get stuck in the new age. What we want to do, and there's a reason why we have two eyes, by the way, I'll talk about this later. One eye follows the bliss, follows the light. The other eye follows the darkness, follows fear. And so in order to really wake up, follow your fear.
Feed your demons.
Feed your demons, yeah. And so this will save you and your teachers a ton of interview time. Because, I mean, really, if you had the chance to meet with great meditation masters, and I annoyed the crap out of dozens of them, the single most common question I hear and I ask is, well, Rinpoche, what should I do? You know, what should I do with my pathetic, silly life? Well, Rinpoche, sometimes it's so embarrassing. Really, I have to share this one story. So 15 years ago, is it okay if I toss these silly stories in? So 15 years ago, you know, as I was going through some emotional relational dealies, it's so pathetic. I'm so pathetic. Positive self-talk. I was going through some emotional, you know, pain. And so I went to Pena Rinpoche, His Holiness Pena Rinpoche, one of the greatest masters in all of Buddhism. I mean, like, this guy is like way up there. And when I look back on it, I'm just so ashamed of myself. And I came up to Rinpoche, and his translator was this amazing Kenpo. So I'm talking to, you know, the president and the vice president of the Dharmic world. And it was like, Rinpoche, you know, I'm having problems with my relationship. Rinpoche, what should I do? And the thing that was so incredible is both Pena Rinpoche and his translator, with tremendous compassion, were looking at me like Tashi, trying to understand me. And here I am, I'm like totally wasting, you know, I'm in front of the Yeti and Elvis Presley after he died, and I don't have a camera. I'm not taking advantage of this. Amazing. And after I left, it took me like 4 years to wake up to the fact. I mean, this is what I should have asked my marriage counselor, right? And these people, they're not marriage counselors. These are Mahasiddhas. And they're sitting there trying, they're going. And the thing that sticks with me out of this story, out of the utter absurdity in me, was their tremendous compassion. How they, you know, if I would have been there in their shoes, I would have gone, ugh, you Westerners, give me an effing break. Go see your therapist. But they were sitting there, and they were trying so hard. to understand my storyline and my neurosis. I was so touched, actually, by their compassion for my idiocy. How do we get there? So,
fear.
Fear, yes. So, if you really, yes. So you'll save your teachers and yourself a lot of interview time. If you say to yourself, self, what can I do in this life to really wake up? Go to the places that scare you. It's why I did my 3-year retreat. At that point, I couldn't think of anything more terrifying for me than being locked up in a compound in a box for 3 years with zero distraction. It scared the crap out of me. I do dark retreat now because, I can't think of anything more terrifying now than facing my mind without zero distraction in this kind of container. And so, obviously, the near enemy here is you don't want me to become a spiritual thrill seeker. And that's a real problem. So if you take this too seriously, if you follow your bliss, you just get blissed out. If you only follow your fear, you'll just get freaked out. And then that's the extreme of that. So somewhere in there, you have to find your middle way. Go to the places that create a little bit of discord, a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of fear. Because fear is the minion of ignorance. It will point you to the light. It will point you to the truth. You can really use this to guide you. And so what we want to do then, and then we'll take a little break and come back. What we want to do, so remember, what we're talking about here, just to back up from yesterday, is we're talking about stage 4 of dream yoga practice, where you create fearful situations, or you work with a nightmare to establish a relationship, there's that word, to establish a relationship with this most unwanted of experiences. And so then what we're doing with this stage, and this is what we'll talk about when we come back from our little break, is we're not only going to be transforming nightmares in the conventional sense, which is what, like I mentioned last night, traditional lucid dream nightmare therapy can do, but what we're going to be doing now, and then when we come back after our break, is we're going to work with the essence of any nightmare, not just a nighttime nightmare, the essence of any nightmare, which is what? Starts with an R. Reification. Reification. Taking things to be real. And so I want to end, before we take our break, with an incredibly powerful quotation. Every morning I do a practice that Trungpa Rinpoche gave us. On Manjushri. Manjushri, some of you may know him, he's a cool dude. He's an archetype, he hangs out here, by the way. He is actually part of us, as is Tara, all these great families of archetypal, spiritual archetypes are all within us. And so my teacher gave me this beautiful practice called Asadana on Manjushri. Manjushri is a really cool dude. He holds a sword in his right hand, which has a double blade. When the blade goes out this way, it cuts through the phenomenal world out there. That's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be wielding this sword starting tomorrow. That sword also comes back in and slices the sense of self. So it's designed to cut through the appearance of self and other. And it's very interesting because the wrathful form of Manjushri, interesting for the Buddhist here, pop quiz, what's the wrathful form of Manjushri? Close. Yamantaka. Yamantaka. Yama is death. Tanka is destroyer. So the wrathful form of knowledge, the wrathful form of wisdom destroys death. How cool is that? So this is not only the way to wake up in a night time dream, it's also actually the way to destroy, to conquer death, by seeing through it, by penetrating through it, and realizing, as Kempo Rinpoche said in the story I shared with you, fundamentally discovering through these teachings that death is an illusion. We're going to be talking very briefly, because it's outside a little bit of the context, Bhakti Yoga really does this, we're going to be talking basically about the death of death. Can you think of anything more powerful than that? The death of death. There's no such thing. There's only death if you identify with form. Death only applies to form. Impermanence only applies to form. So the more you identify with form, the more you're going to have a hard time when you die. If you start to disidentify, differentiate from, release, let go of, die to, which is everything that we're doing here, of this exclusive identification with form, you're practicing how to die.
We're practicing how to die. And so then when the big death happens at the end of time, because we've been preparing, practicing, then you can say exactly what His Holiness Karmapa said. Nothing happens. And when you play on the double entendre of the word nothing, emptiness happens. See? I'm getting the Tashi Mudra. Sorry. It's so sweet. It's okay. Please tease me. Give me some serious feedback. So let's take a little break. When I come back, now I'm going to talk about very practical, psychological applications of how to work with fear. So gritty, really practical applications of how this cosmological principle runs and fundamentally ruins our relative life. So again, post Halloween discussion on fear. No, 20 minutes, please.
20 minutes. Thursday morning, talk 2. Stardate log.
All righty. Okay. It's like right in my ear. I've worn a lot of headsets. This is one of the most uncomfortable. Okay. So just a tiny bit of housekeeping. Is a personal favor to me, I ask you not to record what I'm talking about. On one level, I'm really flattered that what I'm saying is even worth recording. It's amazing. Why would anybody want to record anything? But what we're doing here is we're creating a container, an environment, a mandala, holding environment, that is, it's not quite therapeutic, but not far from. In other words, there's an agreed upon sense of confidentiality here, a sense of openness, of vulnerability that I think we should honor. In fact, as a personal favor to me, I'm asking you, please don't record. I have this image of like, both TSA, you know, I'm gonna put TSA out there, you know, and you have to walk through the screener. And if you're coming through with any weapons, you know, you're gonna be busted. I have this image of the saloon, right? Before you come into saloon, you know, you gotta leave your guns out there. And the reason I have to say, the reason I say this outside, I think it makes sense, right? I'm taking some risks. I'm sharing more than I usually do. And if I know I'm being recorded, I will stop. And I don't want to do that. I want to stay open, habituation to openness. And the reason, what's happened before is, this is no kidding, actually. Somebody will send me, oh, do you realize, you know, you're on YouTube? I'm going, what? And it's like somebody taking a nude photograph and posting it up there. It takes a lot to get me pissed off. But when I saw that, I was pissed off. I mean, what a violation. So I think we make this contract amongst ourselves. This is why we're recording up here. And this is why when we make this available, this is not going to be available. It's going to be available to us. And in fact, the personal stuff will be edited out. So that the sharing that we're doing, you know, Cindy and Bob and I, we're going to go through this whole darn thing. And the personal sharing, we're going to cut it out. It makes sense, doesn't it? Because otherwise, if we're trying to open, and we know we're being recorded, what happens? Close. So really, it's a personal favor to me. It's why we've got two things up here. We are recording this for you. And I ask you as a personal favor to just honor that. It's simple stuff. No big deal. Okay, so now, yeah, fear. Oh, now we're going to get into some very practical type stuff. So, fear. Big deal in the spiritual traditions. And this is why Carlos Castaneda talked about warriorship, Trungpa Rinpoche, Shambhala, the sacred path of the warrior. You know, there really is a quality. It takes courage, it takes bravery to step into the dark and to face the unknown. You know, and this is why we need good maps. That's what I'm doing here. I'm installing in our mind a really healthy GPS system, yeah? That's quite lit up. So that when we make this journey, you know, this is why it's so important to understand the dimensions and strata of mind. And as I mentioned last night, that fundamentally the mind is good, it's pure, it's divine. Fundamentally, there's nothing to be afraid of. In fact, there's everything to look forward to. And as I write about in my book, you know, the three bandwidths of mind, psyche, substrate, clear light, mind. You know, it's in the psyche is this out here, egoic awareness. Clear light mind is you know, Buddha nature, the absolute nature, Dhammakaya, all these synonyms for the God within, the Buddha within, the divine nature. Perfectly pure, that's where we're going. And that's why knowing that is so helpful and so powerful. This is one of the things that separates most of Western psychology with spirituality. Positive psychology a little bit has this idea that, you know, you can trust this. But most, especially because of the legacy of Freud in the Judeo-Christian tradition, most of our pathological models are pathological, that's a Freudian slip. Most of our psychological models are based on a pathology. Something wrong with me, there's something wrong with me. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. You're divine, you're the Buddha. I'm just here to jog your memory. And so if you really know that, then the only problematic, so-called, it's not even problematic if we relate to it properly, is this intermediate bandwidth of mind, that we know what we call the substrate. That's where all the spiders and snakes hang out, right? That's where all the rejected elements hang out. And that's what is very powerful deterrent. And that's what comes up, you know, in psychology and all that kind of thing. And so we have absolutely nothing to be afraid of if we understand the basic goodness, the basic purity, as that beautiful quote from Judith Malinwood last night puts forth, is that really if we truly know, and it takes a while to make this transplant, to make this transition, to trust in your bones that even unwanted experience is in its nature perfectly pure. And if you really trust that and you know that, you become fearless. Your mind becomes big enough that it can contain everything. Just like a loving mother contained the tantrums of her children. And you can cut through, see through, go through the intermediate bandwidth. And that's what we want to talk about now, is what's stuffed into this intermediate bandwidth, which is where fear hangs out. And so fear is contagious, as I mentioned yesterday. It's what makes it so powerful. You see this in nature. You know, one bird takes off, and the whole flock takes off. One bird is startled. The whole flock takes off. One buffalo gets startled and a stampede is created. It's because that's the fear is the default mode network, and we'll see this, the critical, important biological role of fear. If we didn't have fear, we wouldn't be here to contemplate the nature of fear. So we have to look at fear from a systemic, holistic, integral perspective. That's what I want to try to do with you today. But we can see this again, as I said last night. You know, we can see the contagion of fear by look at Bob Woodward's most recent book. Right? What's the title of that book? Fear. Look at what drives so much of politics. Look at the default of what some politicians do that feeds this epidemic. Everybody, oh yeah, I know what that feels like. Fear, fear, fear. And then what do? You contract. You put walls up. You close borders. You shut down. As a self-preservation defensive reaction. And so we're trying to counteract that. But because it's so endemic, not only in our culture, our society, it's endemic in our biology. And this is why this is such a big topic. And this is why it's such a formidable opponent, because it is hardwired into the matrix of our subconscious mind and body. And if we don't understand it, we're going to continue to run from it. And especially the closer we get to the truth, guess what's guarding the truth? Fear. And so when you have fear on the path, I'm not being patronizing here, it's a really good sign. Really good sign. That's the toll. That's the fear. You're starting to get to the truth. And if you don't understand that, you open, and then there's a contraction. If you don't understand that, what are you going to do? because of your biological legacy, social, cultural conditioning, you're going to default into that, contract, and run. You're going to say the spiritual path is bullshit. Is it okay? Sorry about the words. Bull crap. If, you know, it, you know, these deeper processes, it's bull crap because, you know, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't sign up for fear. I signed up to feel good. I want to feel good. Well, we're talking about a goodness that's basic. The spiritual path is not about feeling good in the conventional sense. It's about feeling and getting real. It's not about feeling good in the New Age sense. It's about getting real. And that's where we're going. Because that's fundamentally where this rubber band is calling us. It's calling us back to a goodness, but not relative conventional goodness. It's calling us back to what Trungpa Rinpoche talked about as basic goodness, the fundamental purity that lies even below what we know as conditioned goodness. And so I have to share this story, and this is, again, a very powerful story in my life. It was a very powerful story in Freud's life. It's one reason I might show this video tonight on hypnosis, because this is no small thing. So this is a true story. When Freud was a young medical student, you know, neurologist, he went to see a demonstration of hypnosis. Some of you know the story, so bear with me. And I'm not sure if it was Anton Mesmer or not, mesmerism, mesmerized. But what happened was the following, is there was a demonstration, this particular individual was placed in a hypnotic trance and was given a post-hypnotic suggestion to basically open an umbrella every time he heard a bell, you know? And so what happens, he comes out of his trance, the show is over, so to speak, right? And the guy comes out, everything's normal, and the doorbell rings. And the guy scurries around, goes into the closet, finds an umbrella and opens it over his head. That was his instruction, you know? And, you know, puts it down after a while, phone rings, runs around, finds that umbrella, another one, opens it over his head. And that, I mean, that's kind of amazing, right? I mean, that's kind of amazing. Freud found that really kind of amazing. But what really stunned Freud and actually created the basis of Western psychoanalytic thought, because he really is the father of Western psychology. We have to honor him in so many ways, because really, in so many ways, he introduced us to the model of the unconscious mind. And in many ways, both Freud and Jung, because of especially Freud's monumental interpretation of dreams, these people, Freud and Jung, were incredible in terms of reinstating the power of the dream world. And so what I say here is, in many ways, they weren't innovators. Really, they were restorers. They're part of this cultural temple reconstruction project, because eventually, you know, they were restoring the kind of dangerous relationship that we had to dreams prior to that. But so what floored Freud was not just the fact that these people were opening umbrellas, but what happened next. Because when he or anybody else asked this individual, why are you doing this? He could come up with the most rational, compelling, convincing argument for what is really a completely insane act. Oh, I wanted to see where this one came from. I wanted to see who made this umbrella. Oh, I wanted to see what kind of material it was made of. When fundamentally, what? He had no idea why he was doing what he was doing. Yeah? Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. And lest we think that's a nice story with Freud, what I'm going to try to point out to you now is that we spend our lives opening umbrellas. And we can convince to others, very convincingly, why do you do what you do? Oh, I do this because of whatever. But fundamentally, I argue that we don't know. Fundamentally, I'm arguing what we have given ourselves, what the culture has continued to give us, is a cultural post-hypnotic suggestion, is to avoid fear. Avoid fear of the truth of your inherent non-existence at all cost. And I would argue everything we do, most everything we do in the conventional world, is this very, very sophisticated ego. Ego is an incredibly intelligent illusion, fundamentally. And it devises these very incredible, very sophisticated avoidance strategies. most of which are really about avoiding the truth of our inherent emptiness, our inherent non-existence. And so we spend our lives opening umbrellas, rationalizing to ourselves and others why we do what we do, but as Christ and many other great wisdom masters have said, we have no idea. And even now, classic psychoanalytic thought, I mean, what are the numbers? I mean, something like 95% of what we do is in our so-called conscious lives are dictated by unconscious processes. You know, backstage runs on stage. The darkness still rules the day. We just don't know that. We don't see that because we're relating from that and not to it. And so we live these utterly disingenuous lives until we have some kind of reality breakthrough that says, wait a second, what is this about? What am I really doing? Why am I doing this? Why am I clamoring after fame, fortune? Just fill in the blank. Why? Because there's this fundamental disquietude. You know, originally fear, but even deeper than that is the calling towards truth. But protecting that truth is the most powerful of all deterrents, which is fear. And so this is, again, why we need to talk about this. And so the way this works, and this is again, so cool. We're going to do, stand up. Okay, so I want you to stretch your right arm out. And imagine, put it out as far as you possibly can from you. And out here, I want you to hold on to all your core vulnerabilities. All the things that you don't want. And if you actually start loading this, it gets heavy. And fundamentally, underlying it all, as we will see, all the other little thingies are based on this really heavyweight thing called fear. And so we're putting it out there as far as we can. That's not me. These unwanted, rejected aspects of my heart, mind, that's not me. That's up here. And so it's out there. It's really, really heavy, right? And we don't even know it's so heavy. So again, plant your arm here. It's so heavy, it's planted. You can't move it, right? Okay, now, right, ready? Walk forward. No, you can't do that. You're not doing it right. Back up. You can't do that. How heavy is it? You can't move this thing. What happens? Keep going. You think you're walking forward in life, but you're circumambulating. You're circumambulating all this unwanted crap. You think you're going forward, but you're just walking in a circle. That's a moment-to-moment expression of this. You're circumambulating the stupa of ignorance. You're circumambulating. You're doing kora around ignorance / form, and you don't even know it. You think you're going forward in life, but you're just walking in a circle. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed how things just repeat? Another big mistake, right? But we don't get it. We keep trying. Let's keep walking. Let's walk faster. No, let's go running. Human race. Nowhere. We think we're going forward, but we're just walking in a circle. This is the stupa. This is the samsara. So until we establish a relationship with this, until we can bring it within, lighten it up, we will never go forward. And so what we want to do is take that, own it, bring it here, and now we can start to walk forward. Okay? So that's what we're going to be doing. Cool. All right, so here we go. In order to transcend fear, we need to understand it. We need to establish a relationship to it. And I'm going to do so using an integral approach. And I think by doing this, you will start to see yet again the power of integral thinking. Systemic thinking, holistic, multifactorial thinking. And what I want to do here, if it's okay with you, I virtually never do this, but I'm going to give myself a little creative license. I'm going to read part of my book, just a page, because what I'm going to try to convey here is a little bit dense. It's heavy. Fear is heavy. And I'm just going to, again, it's a risk. I just want to see how this goes over with you. So I'm just going to read this, and then I might pause and make some commentary on it. And what I'm going to do is start with the healthy role of fear. Fear has its place in biological evolution. If we didn't have fear in our biological matrix, we'd be a chicken McNugget on the Serengeti. We would never be here to the point where we can question and challenge this thing called fear. We would not have evolved. So in the role of biological, physical evolution, fear is absolutely necessary. We need it. But what we need to do is we need to understand its place in evolution, separate physical evolution from psycho-spiritual evolution, and keep fear in its biological domain, so it then doesn't dominate psycho-spiritual development. See? And this, by describing this, you will start to see how formidable this force of the dark side is, because it is inculcated in the very DNA of our being, biologically, let alone psycho-spiritually. And that's why understanding this is such a big deal. This is the way we bring this most unconscious of processes into the light of conscious awareness. So let me just read this and I'll riff on it a little bit. At a biological level, fear is essential for survival. If we didn't have it, we would have been breakfast for some bigger beast. Fear is the basis of the primal fight or flight response from a sympathetic nervous system. Fear continues to rule our lives at a human level, where the ego uses it, co-opts it, to ensure its own survival. That at a certain point in evolution, the fear that ensured evolution by facilitating physical survival comes to retard it. As humans trying to evolve spiritually, ego continues to feel the fear that it inherited from the biological realm. But in order to evolve past the ego and therefore past the forms and our exclusive identification with them, we need to evolve past the primordial emotion that developed to guarantee physical survival. This doesn't mean we get rid of fear, because it can still save our life. It means, and this is a Hegelian term that Ken Wilber uses a lot, comes from Hegel, it means that we transcend but include fear. In other words, we work to leave fear at the biological level while transcending it at the spiritual level. Otherwise, fear will continually serve to reify the ego that we are now trying to outgrow. Right? And as Yuval Noah Harari, you know this guy? He's written three astounding books. The first one called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. The second one called Homo Deus, a kind of projection of the future analysis. He's a historian. Third one just came out as 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. This guy's, an incredible historian. And by the way, in his third book, guess what he says is one of the central ingredients for the survival of the human species as it goes forward? Guess what? Meditation. Wow. Wow. He's a Jewish scholar. I recommend his book really highly. Brilliant. So this is what he says. Today we may be living in high-rise apartments with overstuffed refrigerators, but our DNA still thinks we are in the savannah. Continue, that's back to me. If we understand the value of fear and keep it in its evolutionary place, we can more readily leave it in its proper place. We can more easily leave it behind in the physical realm where it belongs. By understanding fear, we make friends with it, even thank it for letting us evolve into the human realm where now we can challenge it. But then we need to let it go. We need to go through it. Without a proper relationship to fear, evolution now flips into devolution. See? Evolution now flips into devolution. That which brought about our evolutionary trajectory to this point now serves to retard our evolution. Hello? Without a proper relationship to fear, evolution flips to devolution. And so here it comes. In order to go from ego to egoless, from beast to Buddha, from dirt to divinity, we need to evolve past the fear that got us to this very evolutionary point. Right? And this is really where it comes home. Fear defends form. Fear defends body. And ego is exclusive identification with body. Ego is exclusive identification with form. When trying to evolve from form to formless, from ego to egolessness, that formlessness is interpreted by the ego, the archetype of form, as what? Starts with a D. Death. Death. Yeah? So basically, what we're doing is this fear that protects, ensures the survival of form. Ego is an exclusive identification with form. When we try to go from ego to egolessness, from form to formlessness, how does our genetic biological matrix relate to that trajectory? Is the fear of death, the fear of annihilation. And so we enter this bipolar relationship to the spiritual path, where part of us, and I'll come back to this later, because we still haven't finished this baby, and how this baby actually works, not only what's called cosmogenically, phylogenetically, the origin of the universe, the origin of the species. This baby also operates in what we term ontogenetically. It's actually within us right now. I'll come back to that later, I promise. And I know I'm deferring some things, but I also want to tie a couple of things in to show you how this process relates to an inner rendering of this, which I didn't finish. I know I didn't finish it. But I think you could start, now start to get the point, is this is one reason why spiritual evolution is so tricky. The fear that we need to transcend is hardwired into our very system. And so with an integral approach to fear, which means honoring and incorporating its facilitating role in evolution while transcending its limitations, we discover that fear has its place. We just need to locate that place and keep it there. And so when we're engaged in really deep meditation and we start, and this fear starts to come up, that's part of our hardwiring. That's in ego's operating system. And if we don't understand it, what's going to happen when you return to that relative matrix of conditioned existence? What's going to happen? Fear is going to win out yet again as you go, this is not for me, man. The spiritual stuff is BS. I didn't sign up for this. It's too rugged. It's too tough. It's too scary. I'm out of here. A spiritual warrior, on the other hand, armed with his GPS system, with his map, when you encounter, you're getting closer to the truth, you start to feel this. Now armed with this map, you say, oh, that's what this is. Wow. Your heart starts to race. You feel like you're going crazy. You feel this tendency to contract, right? You're opening. At a certain point, ego will say, that's far enough, baby. back to form. I'll talk to you about this because this is what happens in my dark retreat. When I go into dark retreat at a certain point, I actually have to do this in the retreat to see if I'm still here. I'm still in this dark cabin. Literally. Okay. So how does this relate to meditators, right? Again, when you go deep into yourself, fear is waiting for you. It's the ground of the relative self, the ultimate defense against truth, against the truth body, the inherent truth of our non-existence. And therefore, it's an extraordinarily powerful deterrent. And I want to end with, we're not there yet. Two things. We're not dead yet. So here's an unbelievably profound quotation. Frank, you know this. Winnie, you probably know this. Of course, it comes from, my guy, Trungpa Rinpoche, with Rinzen Shinpo. Did you ever meet him? Shenpen Hukum? Or Rinzen Shinpo from the UK? Did you ever meet him?
Michael Hukum.
Did you ever meet him?
I never met him personally, but...
I met him in London a couple years ago. This guy was great. I mean, he was a rock star. He's an incredible scholar. And so in...
Is he no longer living?
He's still around.
Oh,
at least he was a couple years ago. And so this is what he says. Now, this is deep spirituality. This relates to this process. It relates to... well, you'll see. I'll just read it. I'm just going to read it without too much commentary. It's dense. It's thick. But it's so profound. What Trungpa Rinpoche and Hukam are talking about here is basically the origin of the cosmos, the origin of self, the origin of all up here. And this is what he says. The overpowerful creative energy breaks away from its source and becomes avidya, ignorance, which ignores or forgets the source. This is the first establishment of the ego, and from it, fear springs when one realizes that one is an individual and alone. Just as fear was the first reaction to arise when the breaking away from the source took place, so it tends to be the last barrier to the return to the source. As one begins to return to the source on the spiritual path, fear may arise. He's being very polite. I will tell you, fear will arise. Due to a sensation of impending annihilation, and this fear must be fully entered into before the return to our true nature, back to the source, can be accomplished. And so, to put it in my lingo, I'm not talking about spiritual practice, I'll come back to this. Fear is the first primordial archetypal force in the descent of involution. And so, the first forms of involution, guess what? Are therefore what we meet in the last stages of evolution, right? So, just as they say here, the closer you get to this, here's fear here, there's fear there. The closer you get to the truth, the more you're going to return to this primordial relative matrix of the conditioned world. This is so helpful to me. Am I just talking to myself? This is so helpful. And so one last thingy, and this comes from an incredible book, truly one of the best books I've read in the last 5 years, by a dear, dear friend of mine, really borderline genius, in my opinion. His name is Bruce Tift. I think last year, for those of you here, I mentioned this guy. I love this guy to death. My friends know him. He's one of the most brilliant, what I call, spiritual psychologists, really, on this planet. I mean, this guy is amazing. And what makes him so cool is he couldn't care less about fame and fortune. I mean, he's just like the silent genius that sits around. And I've done professional work with him. He's actually my therapist. And he's also a dear heart friend. And what I do with Bruce is just, it's a gas because he has so much to offer, but he's utterly recalcitrant. He just doesn't care. And so what I do is I go, come on, Bruce, let's go. Let's go to the Integral Central and do a talk. And I don't want to. Come on, Bruce. So I go over there. I literally almost go to his house and pull him out. Come on. And so we go up. We did a thing in a bold Integral Center. And he's very confrontational in an incredibly skillful way. Yeah, you know him. From Naropa. I love this guy. And I bring him out to different Buddhist meditation centers. Come on, Bruce, let's get out there. He couldn't care less. And that honestly is what magnetizes me to him, because he just speaks his truth and doesn't really care where it lands. And I was asked to be a reader for this book, and I endorsed it. And so this is what Bruce says about this, that is, when I read this, I mean, I was just blown away. So I'm going to read it quite slowly. It's two paragraphs from this unbelievable book. Shariputra, write this down. Do you know who Shariputra was?
No.
Yeah. Shariputra was, yeah.
I just don't remember.
He was the student of the Buddha who always asked the questions, who always really just seated.
That wasn't the one that was like, he knew everything. That was Anna.
No, Shariputra was that guy.
No, he was that guy. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
See, that's you, man. So Shariputra, write this down. The book is called Already Free, Buddhism Meets Psychotherapy and the Path of Liberation. Read it. And this is what he says around this. From a Buddhist point of view, And this now again not applies just to fear. Fear is the primordial unwanted experience. He's talking about everything that is then conflated, added on top of fear. This whole bed that lands here that we then walk our life around in an attempt to avoid. But we're going to see that it's not just out here now. You know, this image of fear not being, it's not just out here. What we're going to transition to is this fear is actually in the center of our relative self. It's actually in here. And you'll see where we're going here. So from a Buddhist point of view, our commitment to not feeling disturbing emotions, such as fear, gives rise to a very convincing sense that we have some central, essential nature. Our lives indeed seem to be formed around something, and that something feels deeply problematic to us. By practicing our avoidance strategies over and over, day after day, for decades, we become experientially convinced that there must be a central point around which our lives revolves. The centerpiece of our being is composed of our core vulnerabilities, which are perceived as problematic. Our life revolves around a problem. And that problem must be our secret self, because it's always been there and never seems to change. Oddly enough, this belief serves us, because it means we don't have to consider the possibility that there is no center to our lives, and therefore no independently existing self. Something bad, paren, is better than nothing. Something bad is better than nothing. Back to Bruce. Instead, we can spend our lives in therapy or spiritual practice, trying to somehow heal or take care of that seemingly solid problematic self that we've created. At this point, we might attempt to improve our experience of the problem through Western therapy, or we might try to experience no self through spiritual practices like meditation. But we're still motivated and moved by a fundamentally paranoid attitude that there is some problem needing to be fixed. But when we actually recover what has been disowned, and that's what we're doing here, we're recovering, discovering, uncovering this fear, these core vulnerabilities. When we actually recover what has been disowned and bring it into our immediate embodied experience, we see that it's not going to kill us. We begin to dissolve our sense of having an essential self. We discover that, absent a central struggle, we have no center to ourself. We have no center to our life at all. We just show up each moment and deal with our life as it happens. Wow. To me, wow. What truth is condensed in this? And it is a fantastic segue for exactly what we're going to be doing when we return from our break. We're now starting to unearth this ignorance, which is, again, based on form. We're going to transplant that with wisdom, which is based on formlessness, i.e. emptiness. We will unearth this, the center of the samsara mandala that we circumambulate, the kora of ignorance, the stupa of ignorance. We will replace that with the stupa of wisdom. And that will allow us to move forward in life, with fear now as a companion, not as a sublimated avoidance mechanism. And the only way we can do that is by establishing, understanding, and establishing a relationship to these disowned, disenfranchised aspects of our being. These types of what are called reverse meditations that I'll talk about. I keep promising all this stuff. I'm not going to promise anything. I'm not going to talk about anything. Sorry. But you see, this is where we're going. I think this is a really fine segue to take what Bruce is saying here, and now with Frank's help, we're now going to unpack this. Much ado about nothing, as Shakespeare said. Much ado about nothing. We're now going to work with transplanting the heart of ego with the heart of the Buddha, which of course is already what's here. We just need to see through the illusion of form, which dream yoga does, the teachings on emptiness does, the practice of illusory form does. All the practices circumambulate these central teachings that we are about to get into. And I can think of no more pithy, beautiful summary about where we're going than this. Okay? So questions, comments around this? Does this speak to you? Does it resonate to you? Or am I the only one that is excited about this? I read this. I just find it breathtaking. I find it so revelatory, so explanatory. And if you take, this is a contemplation that really should almost be memorized to really look, is this in fact the case? Is this in fact the case? Do I in fact spend my life avoiding unwanted feelings? Avoiding unwanted experiences? What do I do when I avoid them? Do I throw them out here? I think I do, but no, what are you doing? You're throwing them into the center of this refuse heap, where they continue to accrete, heavy, 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 and you think you're walking forward, you're just walking in a circle. The very definition of, by the way, of samsara, the wanderers, recyclers. That's the definition of samsara, recycling, recycling, recycling. Look at your life experience. Look at your mind and meditation. Recycling, 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 recycling. The same old pathetic story. Yeah? Same old story. Oh, another relationship, another job. Same story. Same story. Same story. Until we wake up to the process and allow ourselves to relate to it instead of from it. Does this make sense?
For what it's worth, I just want to insert some Shambhala language in this conversation. Probably should have done it in my previous talk, but it didn't. Trungpa often said that fear is not the obstacle to warriorship, but the avoidance of fear is the obstacle. And he expressed that as the cocoon of habitual patterns. So the cocoon of habitual patterns is our seeking comfort in the avoidance of that which we fear. And so he said that cowardice is the greatest obstacle to becoming a warrior, not fear.
How lovely.
And so what you were saying about fear has to become our companion, fear has to become our ally. Fear is our ally.
Yeah.
Fear is an expression of tremendous wakefulness. So biologically, like you were saying, we woke up to the fact that our fear was waking us up to these threats to our survival. So that's a very, very positive thing. But eventually, the threat to our physical survival is no longer the issue. It's the threat to the ego's survival.
That's right.
Your Zen teacher, Joko Beck, talked about this as the difference between true fear and false fear.
Yeah, beautiful. Yep.
So false fear is the fear with which we would weave the cocoon. And this is what we expose in meditation. This is all one step at a time. And the reason that we are so resistant to meditating, we have this alternation of longing and resistance.
Right.
The longing is because we know the cocoon is a prison and it's holding us back. The resistance is we're terrified at the idea of living without the cocoon, without the cocoon to keep us company.
Yeah.
And that's why meditation is so challenging.
Yeah.
Because we want to go toward it, but we're afraid to go toward it. So it's this constant double bind.
That's the bipolar relationship.
Of the cocoon. So I just wanted to insert those another kind of metaphor for describing the same thing.
Beautiful. Thanks, Frank, very much. Yeah. Anybody else? Questions, comments? Does it land? Does it not land?
Yes.
We're good?
I think of Groundhog's Day when you're talking about it.
Yeah, Groundhog Day, yeah. Devin? I'm sorry.
Yes, it is. Play that over.
So I'm still interested in if fear is going to become my ally and friend, I'm interested in how to do that. And specifically, in terms of the night practices, my experience has been that when, and not nightmares, but rather just like feeling a sort of transient, unstable nature of reality creates a kind of visceral fear that then does wake me up. Or does kind of like set off some like deep body alarm systems. And so I don't know how to practically work with that experience in the night meditation.
Yes, great
so
question.
That's my very specific
Yes, exactly.
Question.
Well, let me take a stab at it and see if there's a response to that. First and foremost, what you do is you simply allow yourself to be with it, number one. And that's no small thing. You can't establish a relationship to something you don't spend time with. And because fear is such a powerful deterrent, because it's some, you know, kind of a default mode network, usually the minute we feel it, we hit the eject button. And so the very first thing you do, there is no small thing, is you simply stay with it. And then what you do, second thing you do, is you, after you stay with it, then you start to use the crucible of your body. You start to use the wisdom of your body as the crucible for transformation. And what this means is then you start to work with the relationship of what you're feeling in your body, which is usually, if you examine it and requires you to stay with it, you'll find something that we append the label unsettling, fearful, whatever. And this you have to find out for yourself. For me, when I do this, I literally feel contraction. I literally feel somatic, visceral contraction in my gut, around my heart. I feel this closing. And then what happens instantaneously with that is instantaneous with that closing is the ejection. It's almost like when I contract, I squirt into this. And then comes the machinations, the spin doctors, all the commentary about what I'm feeling. Instead of staying with the feeling, which allows you to establish a relationship to it, which that in and of itself is transformative, part of me says, I don't want to stay with this. This doesn't feel good. This is whatever, scary, whatever. There's already a commentary on that. I feel the contraction. I stay in my body. I feel it. This is not easy to do. It takes a warrior's mentality based on maps like this. This is the hearing part, the understanding part, the contemplating part, and now we're at the meditating part. So you stay with it. You feel it like, man, this does not feel good. But just as Bruce says here, if you stay with it long enough, you realize this is not going to kill you. It just doesn't feel good if it's referenced to self. If we don't refer it, and again, this is beautiful because when we start our meditations tomorrow, we're now going to start to transition from form referential shamatha to formless non-referential shamatha. So the armamentarium of skillful means that we'll give to you tomorrow will now give you another gift to work with this. But you feel the contraction, you feel exactly everything you're saying. Number one, stay in the crucible of your body. This is where the alchemy takes place. Your body can handle it. Notice the propensity for the contraction. It's almost like squeezing a ketchup bottle. Boom, it goes up here. I'm out of here, man. We check out. It's like James Joyce said of one of his characters. It's this fantastic quotation. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. It's beautiful. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. You want to know about out-of-body experiences? We're living one our entire life. Because we don't want to acknowledge the truth of these somewhat uncomfortable experiences. So what do? We hit the eject button. We disembody. We have an out-of-body experience. We contract. You feel it. Stay with that. Stay with that. Man, this does not feel good. Stay with that. Almost like Lamaze. Breathe. You're birthing. Breathe. Breathe into it. Breathe into it. Open. Notice the eject button. Bang. It pops up. Bang. Bang. And the minute it comes up here, what happens? For those of you who are Buddhists, fourth and fifth skanda. Kicks up here. The winds take control, you know, and you get blown away. And all this stuff comes up. You know, the default mode network says, blah, 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 blah. The storyline doesn't matter. You notice that. You go, eject button. Okay. Eject button. Back to earth. Back to earth. What's that song by, I can't remember. There's a really cool song, a rock and roll song. I play Dead White Man's music. I'm a classical musician, so I can't remember. There's a really cool song about this. But the idea is you feel it, you stay with it. That in itself is transformational. And then just see where it takes you. Be curious. This is the Vipassana component. Where am I feeling this in my body? What does it feel like? What happens if I do the opposite of what I normally do? What happens if I allow myself to go fully into this? What happens if I do that? That alone starts the alchemical. Now you're mixing the goods into the cauldron of transformation, which again, the crucible of which is your body. Your body can handle this. The problem is when you hit the eject button and you come up here, okay? That in and of itself is no small thing. And then just see what happens. And then you talk to a meditation instructor or you talk to somebody else who may have some experience with this, and they will help you because, you know, what tends to happen, again, ego is very sophisticated, very clever. It will find very subtle ways to, you know, say, whatever, you get the idea. It's helpful to have, and this is what we'll be doing. I'll introduce this topic to you on Saturday, you know, the like ways to continue as a group once this is over, to work with these sorts of things, to support each other. Okay, so something like that? Yeah. Read Bruce's book. Read this book. Anybody else? Already Free. Already Free. Buddhism meets psychotherapy on the path of liberation. Has anybody read this book in this room? Yeah, I mean, what do you think? Like, not bad, huh? In my opinion. Anybody else? Rishon? Let's wait for the mic. Thank you, Carrie. Carrie is carrying the mic.
I work with children, and many of the children I work with have phobias. And in the medical setting, many of them have phobias of needles.
Of what?
Needles.
Oh, tell me about needles. I know about needles.
And I use this work when I work with them, but it's not the same words. And I just wanted to reiterate the effort and the time it takes to move through the kind of fear that is so visceral and so terrifying for these children.
Yeah.
And they vary in age from very, very young to young adults. That's the age range I work with.
Yeah.
And one particular young lady who is 16, she is very confident, very bright, very amazing individual. And she is absolutely terrified of needles to the extent that for 2 days beforehand, she can't function.
Right.
She knows she has to have lab work.
Right.
But by working through with the principles and the what ifs and going through exposure, which is what we do here, that physical exposure, walking to the lab, sitting in the chair, having the swab, feeling the needle against the skin. Smelling the smell.
Yeah, beautiful.
She's moving through.
Beautiful. Yeah, you know, thank you for sharing that. I mean, Leanna and I mean, we work with needles, you know. I mean, I'm throwing needles into people's faces 50, 60 times a day. So, and kids too. And so what immediately came to my mind is when I teach my Bardo programs in Boulder, we do things like go to anatomy labs and hang out with cadavers. We do things like go to crematoriums and mortuaries. We do things that are, you know, like a little bit weird from a conventional point of view, but as in exactly the same way as a way to develop familiarity, to decondition, to basically establish a more sensitive, heightened relationship to, in this case, death. And so what you're talking about, this fundamental principle has vast application, as you pointed out, to so many areas of phobias, fears, whatever, and you can decondition by doing exactly what you're talking about here. It just takes a lot of kindness, love, and patience. Thanks for sharing that. That's great. Ellen?
I don't really have a question as such, but more just a confirmation of how much I agree and how I've just had a couple of amazing experiences in lucid dreams of facing my fear, which have just resolved lifelong problems. One of them was a PTSD type thing that I had virtually in my life, and got rid of through a lucid dream where I just faced the monster, and in the end, just dissolved into pixels. pixels and disappear, and then I never had a nightmare again, and basically got over childhood abuse in one night.
Wow.
And then last night, I just wanted to share, I mean, I know nobody's really talking publicly.
No, it's great. Please. It's
but I mean, it was the first time I've ever taken galantamine, and it was a totally incredible experience. I had an incredibly lucid dream, and I remembered what you'd said about facing the fear. And at first, it was just sort of Disneyland. I was like the baby going, wow, so much amazing stuff. What? And all this being my mind, and then all of a sudden there was something scary. And it was this guy, and his face just kept changing, but it was always a scary face. I don't know if it was wrong with his mask. It was like all these mask faces coming up. But I decided to just stare at him and try and feel love towards him. And then all of a sudden, another guy came up to me with a knife, and he said, I'm going to stab you. And I just went, I love you. And so he stabbed me, and I felt the knife go in, but it wasn't painful. But I could sort of feel it go through my ribs, and I was like, well, it's not that bad. And then I just said, thank you, I love you. And then he just said, amazing, that karma, well done, you just purified that karma. And I was like, wow. And I just, I mean, for me, this is why I'm here, because for me, lucid dreaming, that's probably just 5 years therapy, not necessary. No fear of knives, that's over there. I mean, if I have a few more dreams like that, I mean, I think I'll be done, you know. Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's awesome. That's it. I couldn't have planted a better story than that. That's it. In one night. I read a story about a physician, psychiatrist, Zapataro, who he said something like, you know, he had a patient who had 25-year history of chronic pain. And cured himself of 25 years of chronic pain overnight with one lucid dream. And he writes in his paper, he says, you know, I am no expert in lucid dreaming, I am no mystic, but the guy walks in one day, returns all his meds to the VA pharmacy, and he says, that's pretty convincing. One night. Yeah. That's what a beautiful, beautiful dream. Thank you for sharing that. Anybody else? Yeah, Dennis. Oh, wait, sorry, let's wait for the mic.
Are you asking for an experience or question?
At this point, whatever, if this is open.
I just kind of want to follow up a little bit on Sarah's question as far as the self-discipline techniques you might employ for both staying down in your heart, but also, since I'm specifically interested in increasing my ability to meditate within the lucid dream, there's such a fine line between self-discipline, no, I'd rather just go fly to Mars versus, I need to focus. I need to focus on staying lucid. And because that will make me go into my head when I'm really being hard on myself about making sure I stay clear.
Right.
So techniques that we could employ and try and play with, if you don't mind.
To better stay with and practice in our dreams, kind of
thing? Employ that self-discipline to stay on track and not let the fear take you to your head or not let, you know, distract from meditation, but not be so hard, you know, like you say, wake up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Again, so we always play, you know, the analogy is given of an instrument, you know, violin or guitar, not too tight, not too loose. If it's too tight, the string breaks. If it's too loose, no music. So in order to make beautiful night music, we have to tune our mind, and only we can do that. Not too tight, not too loose. And so this is one of the reasons this practice is a wee bit advanced, considered a wee bit subtle, is because nobody knows your mind better than you. Nobody knows your idiosyncrasies, vicissitudes better than you. And so the best I can do is arm you with basic skill sets, and then send you on your way with this parameter. And so if you come in and you're too tight, you know, that'll backfire.
you'll get tired of it. You'll just say, this is just too intense, too tight. Or are you trying to go to sleep at night and you're so wound up with the induction methods, you won't even fall asleep, too tight. If you go in, whatever, you capitulate, you wake up in your lucid dream, I'm just gonna go to my 50, orgy, then that's too loose. And so somewhere in there, we have to find our way. And you do that by exactly what you're saying, Devin, is you actually start to become aware of that and you start to set the intentionality with yourself. That, tonight, I would recommend people, just like Milarepa once said of the spiritual path altogether, so beautiful. He said, hasten slowly. Take your time, be kind to yourself. One night when the lucidity is really clear, this is what I do. I can't remember if I said this here. What dictates the practices that I do in the night is largely the strength of my lucidity. I mean, when I wake up in my, I know I'm in like a really strong, hyper-lucid dream, I go right to stage 7, 8, 9, and I try to drop into sleep yoga. If I wake up and I'm like, you're so, lucid, not that strong today, I'll hang out in stages 1, 2, 3, right? And so, depending on the strength of my awareness that night, I kind of work with the bandwidth of practices depending on that. And all the while framed with the intentionality of just what you're saying. And really, if I have to say something, maybe erring on the side of being a little bit too loose. Because if you're too tight, you just won't do this. It doesn't get fun anymore. If it's not somehow enjoyable or if it doesn't fit into your, kind of schedule, things, you're just not going to do it. And maybe with that, you just find out what works for you. Okay?
Thank you.
Is that helpful? Yeah. Maybe one last one before we, or are we done?
Unless anybody else wants to be
up. No, you go. You're good.
My dream wasn't lucid after I took the pill,
but
it was vivid, and it was interesting. I just realized what I learned right now, I dreamt that I was in the ocean, and I've always had this fear of sharks, and whenever I dream about...
It's a healthy fear, by the way.
It's a healthy fear.
That's what we call wholesome fear.
So I would always, freak out, swim away from them, and escape. But this time, I allowed it to come. I welcomed it. I just let it approach me.
Oh, sweet.
And then it was huge too. And then when it got really close, it turned into a toy.
Toy?
Yeah, like a teddy bear, a stuffed animal. And I had this like, it was like a friendly shark. So that was interesting.
There's some lucidity. There's some lucidity. You may not have had a full blown lucid dream. There's something happening there. Yeah, Eddie, please continue. Yeah, cool.
Oh, so that's all I want to share.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Reminds me of Saturday Night, remember Land Shark, right? Yeah. Land Shark. Okay, hey. School's out for the summer. You do not have to come back at 7:30. If you want to, whatever. It's open. But we are going to meet here at 7:30. There's some questions in Thanos here. We'll address those. I got some really, really cool videos. Bring your popcorn. Let's just see what the heck happens. In other words, it's super loose, super informal. We need a little bit of space. We need to breathe. Relax into this. So have a great afternoon, and I'll see you here at 7:30, okay?